All right, well, we'll slowly start, even though there's some of you searching for seats. Well, it's a very great pleasure and an honor for me to welcome Bob Wade here this evening.
Robert Wade.
Robert Wade here this evening. And I'm not giving the lecture. He is Professor of Political Economy here at the LSE, a New Zealand citizen. Are you still a New Zealand citizen? A New Zealand citizen. And has taught at many universities, I don't know what that means, but it's certainly many, Victoria, Sussex, Princeton, MIT, and Brown universities, and has held fellowships at a number of advanced studies institutes, including the Institute of Advanced Studies at Princeton and the one in Berlin. In the 1980s, he worked as a staff economist at the World Bank, and later as an analyst at the Office of Technology Assessment, an arm of the US Congress. He's written many books. The author of Irrigation and Agricultural Politics in South Korea, 1982, Village Republics, 1988, and Governing the Market, Economic Theory and the Role of Government in East Asia, in 1990, which won a very distinguished American Political Science Association prize for the best book of that year. More recently, Robert Wade has written extensively about the Asian financial crisis and about governance of international financial markets. He wrote a rather special essay, a by-invitation essay, in The Economist not so long ago on world income distribution, its structure, causes, consequences, and what public action might be taken. That was published on the 28th of April, 2001, and it's a very fine piece. I hope it's accurate because I've been quoting it extensively, and I was quoting it extensively in New York at the World Economic Forum recently, and was persistently challenged. But I've taken it that it was entirely authoritative, and he will be pursuing those arguments today. He's currently working on a book about the World Bank, the United States, and the environment called Paved with Good Intentions. Robert has just published a round letter exchange with Martin Wolf of the Financial Times about world poverty, inequality, and globalization in Prospect. It's the very latest issue of Prospect, and I think this is an absolutely crucial exchange with very major political consequences, as we'll be seeing in the talk and discussion today. And for those of you who are interested, I would urge you to get a copy of Prospect and have a look at it. It really is interesting, excellent, and very important. Finally, I welcome him as the second Miliband lecturer in our Global Economic Governance series, and he'll be talking for about 50 minutes. Those of you who are the first one know why I'm stressing 50 minutes. The first one was a great moment and interest, but it did go on for a long time. So I'll be timing him 50 minutes, give or take a few minutes of discretion, and he's talking to the themes of economic globalization, inequality, and debt. And after that, there should be plenty of time for discussion, and I hope we'll have an opportunity to really pursue some of the issues in depth. So welcome, Robert. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is the issue of Prospect that David referred to. The photographs of Martin Wolf and me are alone worth the price of the issue. Some of the ground, at least, that I'm covering tonight is also covered in the form of a letter exchange between Martin Wolf, in fact, three letter exchanges between Martin Wolf and myself. I'm afraid this microphone is beginning to buzz. My talk tonight, Globalization, Inequality, and Debt. Can I get some help with the microphone? Is anybody there?
You might want to just take it down your time, just to see if that helps if you lower it a bit.
I could take it off. Can you hear me at the back if I don't use the mic?
Yeah.
Okay. My title is Globalization, Inequality, and Debt. I want to divide it into three parts. First part, about trends in world poverty and world income distribution. The second part about causes, and the third part about public policies. I want to cut straight to the chase and draw your attention to this. This is one way of representing the distribution of world income. It shows world population according to the per capita income, the average income of the countries in which people live, so that this large red area down here is where countries like sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia are This diagram actually divides China and India both into two countries, rural and urban, so that rural India and rural China are down at the lower end, and urban India and urban China are higher up at a higher per capita income. And basically the feature that I want to draw your attention to is just how bipolar it is, the great mass of world population living down in these very low income zones, and then a little tiny hump where about 15% of the world's population lives right up at the other end. And this strange feature of the missing middle, that is almost nobody lives in this middle zone of per capita income, that is an observation for which there is no good explanation. Another way to show world income distribution is like this. This shows world population divided into quintiles, so each quintile represents 6.2 billion people divided by 5, and this shaded area indicates the proportion of world income that accrues to people in each quintile level. It is carefully drawn so as to resemble one of the best known symbols of affluence. The champagne accrues to the people in the top 20%, and the rest of the world's population are basically supporting the champagne at the top. Roughly 85% of world income accrues to the top 20%, and about 6% of world income accrues to the bottom 60%. That is how unequal world income distribution is. And the question is, can this degree of inequality be legitimized by any principle, any normative principle known to man? Can it be legitimized, for example, by the veil of ignorance test? Would people choosing the shape of world income distribution in advance, if they had no idea where they would end up in the distribution, would they choose a shape as unequal as we have today? Or can you possibly make an argument that this degree of inequality is a necessary condition for the poor to be better off than they would otherwise be, that is, than they would be with a more equal income distribution? I would suggest that in both cases the answer is no, but I'm not even going to argue the case that this inequality, degree of world inequality, is a bad thing. I'm just going to assert it. But the thunder and lightning of debate is not so much to do with the magnitude of inequality. The thunder and lightning of debate is more to do with the trend, that is, what has been happening over, say, the past 20 years, happening to the number of people in the world living in absolute poverty, living on a purchasing power parity income of, say, less than $1 a day, and the number of people and the degree of the way in which the degree of inequality has been changing over the past 20 years. That's what the current debate is about. There is a strong argument in good currency that, first of all, things have been getting better over the past 20 years. That is, the proportion of the world's population in absolute poverty has been going down. Indeed, the number of people in absolute poverty has either been going down or remained constant, and the degree of income inequality has been going down over the past 20 years. Point number one. Point number two in this argument in good currency is that these good things have been delivered by globalization. Globalization in the sense of increasing ratios of trade to income, increasing ratios of foreign investment to income, increasing volumes of financial transactions to real transactions. These indices of increasing economic integration have been driving these good things. And therefore, the policy conclusion is that the world needs more integration, more globalization. And that, of course, is then used to challenge all those people out in the street who are called anti-globalizers, who are at least presented as arguing for a return to closed economies. And the fourth point then, is how to get more globalization. The way to get more globalization is to have freer trade, lower restrictions on foreign direct investment, free capital movements. These are the policy actions that governments, all governments, very much including developing country governments, should be taking. And those, having taken those actions, then they will enjoy the benefits of increased integration into the world economy. So what has happened in terms of the development debate is that development strategy has been more or less reduced to an integration strategy, a strategy for integrating countries into the world economy, supplemented by a number of domestic reforms which are thought to be necessary for that integration to be viable, such as tougher bank regulation, such as strengthening of domestic tax raising capability so that as tariffs come down, domestic taxes can be raised to protect government revenues. And not only these, but also the agenda of good governance, of anti-corruption, of transparency, of participation, of democratization, all these things are part of this integration agenda because these things help to make integration into the world economy viable. Now, you will find this argument made if you look in any World Bank publication, if you look at the DFID white paper on globalization, if you look at any issue of The Economist or the Financial Times, and if you pay a special attention to the writings of Martin Wolf, this is what they're saying. And indeed, even if you read the writings of Tony Giddens, you will find an argument made along broadly these kind of lines. So, let us look at the evidence. And begin with the poverty numbers. That is the number of people in the world living in absolute poverty, namely purchasing power parity income of less than $1 a day. The year 2000, the World Bank came out with the conclusion that in both 1987 and 1998, the number of people living in absolute poverty in the world was 1.2 billion. And that was presented as both good and bad news. The good news was that world population had increased so that the proportion of the world's population in absolute poverty had fallen a lot. The bad news was that the absolute numbers had not fallen. But on the whole, this was presented as good news. The problem is that there is actually great uncertainty about the meaning of these figures. Martin Wolf makes a lot of play of the difference, the fall of 200 million people between 1980 and 1998. That, just let me say quickly in passing, is totally illegitimate because the bank changed the methodology for calculating these numbers, and it's just not clear how this number relates to this number. But the more important point I want to make has to do with this comparison, because these two numbers were calculated with the same methodology. The bank changed its methodology for calculating these numbers in 2000 and then calculated backwards to 1987. And with that backwards calculation came out with this figure of 1.2 billion in both 98 and in 87. The problem is that external researchers at Columbia University, who have been trying for months very hard to find out how the bank arrived at these numbers, what the methodology was, why the bank changed the methodology from the previous one, have found the bank very unforthcoming. By the bank, I mean the people who do these numbers. Very unforthcoming, very untransparent about why they changed. And there is some indication, but I stress some indication, that the new method by which these figures were calculated uses a lower poverty line, than the old method, and therefore comes up with a lower number of people living in absolute poverty than the old method. And because of the political sensitivity of these numbers are very politically sensitive, the Meltzer Commission that made this head-on criticism of both the bank and the fund on behalf of the US Congress pointed to these poverty numbers to indicate that the bank was not doing very well in reducing world poverty, and then the bank had to defend itself against these kind of attacks. So these numbers are politically very sensitive. And given that, it is at least possible, one has to entertain suspicion, that the second the bank changed its methodology in 2000, because that new methodology would yield lower numbers of people in poverty and therefore make the bank's performance look better. We should have some idea pretty soon of whether this rather cynical hypothesis has any truth, because these external researchers at Columbia University are soon to publish their analysis behind these figures using the method that they have been able to deduce that the bank used, the second method that the bank used. We should have some idea fairly soon of this, the truth of this hypothesis. But in any case, put aside manipulation of the figures, it turns out that all these poverty numbers are extremely sensitive to apparently technical and arcane details of the survey design. For example, in the Indian case, these numbers come by going out and asking people about their income and expenditure. I mean, that's one part of the methodology. Well, it turns out that if you, the surveyor, if you reduce the reporting period from 30 days, so you're asking people not how far, what they were, what their income and consumption was 30 days back, but instead just 7 days back, that switch from a 30-day reporting period to a 7-day reporting period immediately reduces the number of people in absolute poverty in India by 50%. 50%. That is to say, 175 million people suddenly vanish out of absolute poverty just by changing the reporting period from 30 days to 7 days. Unfortunately, the conclusion is not that therefore you should always use a 7-day reporting period, because if you use a 7-day reporting period, you miss out on a whole lot of like monthly payments or big discontinuous payments. So the Princeton-based economist Angus Deaton, who knows about these statistics probably better than anybody else, has written a recent paper, a very good paper, in the World Bank Research Observer, and he concludes that the problems involved in the calculation of these kind of numbers are so big, the margins of uncertainty are so large, that, and this is a quote, we are simply not able to make well-supported statements about what is surely a central issue in economic development, namely whether growth has reduced poverty in the past or whether growth is likely to reduce growth in the future. That's how big the margins of uncertainty behind these figures are. Now let me come to world...
Robert, before you do that, do you want to give me your mic?
Yes.
Then the background noise of your pocket will
Sorry.
Be cut off.
Great. Okay, let me come to now to trends in world income distribution. By this, I'm meaning the distribution of income amongst all 6.2 billion people in the world, regardless of where they live. Everybody wants to have unambiguous statements. Everybody wants to be able to say, yes, world income inequality is reducing, or world income inequality is becoming wider. The trouble is, this treats inequality as something like temperature. We may have different ways of measuring temperature, but they actually all measure basically the same thing. But in the case of inequality, the different measures measure different things, and we may be interested in income for quite different kinds of reasons. In particular, and I'm going to rush over some stuff that's very, very slightly technical. Don't panic; it won't last for very long. In particular, in measuring world income inequality, we have to make at least four choices. And I'll just present these as dichotomous choices, even though in fact they're not. First choice is whether to use something like the Gini coefficient of inequality, or whether to, which kind of measures especially what is happening in the middle of the distribution, or whether to use a measure like decile or quintile ratios, top quintile to bottom quintile, which captures better what is happening at the extremes. That's choice number one. Choice number two is whether we weight countries by population or whether we treat each country as an equal unit. Point number three is, do we convert income in the different countries into one common currency, such as the US dollar, using simply market exchange rates? Or do we use this thing called purchasing power parity, which is an attempt to adjust incomes according to market exchange rates, according to the actual purchasing power of currencies in the different countries? I'm not even going to explain further what purchasing power parity means, but most of you, I think, probably know. That's, in any case, the third choice, whether to use market exchange rates or whether to use purchasing power parity. And the fourth choice is whether to use household surveys, surveys just based upon surveying of households, people living in households, or whether to use national income accounts, which include surveys of production entities, government agents, and other kinds of economic agents. So if we treat these four choices as dichotomous, which is misleading but useful, we have over 10 possible combinations of measures for measuring world income inequality. And the basic point I want to make is that some of these combinations are more appropriate for some questions than for others, whereas in the normal debate, people forget to make this qualification that the trends that you get depend on which combination of these measures you are using. Let me give an illustration or two. If you take one of these, that is whether to use purchasing power parity or market exchange rates, it's clear that if we're interested in income as a measure of well-being, so that if we're interested in income distribution as a measure of the distribution of well-being, then in principle we should use purchasing power parity. There are all kinds of landmines in using purchasing power parity, but in principle we should try and make that adjustment. However, we may also be interested in income and its distribution because we're interested in questions of power, questions of marginalization. That is the marginalization, say, of developing countries or the power of developing countries. In fact, for most of the issues that concern the world at large, issues like migration flows, issues like the capacity of developing countries to repay their debts, or their capacity to import capital goods, and more broadly, if we're interested in a whole range of questions about the impact of developing countries on the rest of the world, then we should measure their incomes in terms of market exchange rates, not in terms of purchasing power parity. After all, the reason why many poor countries are hardly represented in negotiations at the WTO, in the World Bank, in the IMF, in negotiations about things that vitally concern their interests, is because of the cost of hotels and offices and salaries in places like Geneva and New York and Washington. But this cost is not in terms of purchasing power parity dollars, it's in terms of actual dollars in the hand. They don't have enough dollars in the hand to be represent themselves in these vital negotiations. And that requires you to measure their incomes not in purchasing power parity terms, but in terms of market exchange rates. The significance of this point, the significance is that everybody agrees, I'm sure even Martin Wolf agrees, that world income distribution measured in terms of market exchange rates as distinct from purchasing power parity has been becoming rapidly more unequal over the past 20 years, rapidly more unequal over the past 20 years. And indeed, it turns out that the people who argue that world income distribution is becoming more equal, implicitly or explicitly use one combination out of the more than 10 possible combinations. Namely, they use the Gini coefficient, they use population-weighted countries, so that China weights very heavily, for example. Thirdly, they use purchasing power parity, not market exchange rate. And fourthly, they use national accounts, not household surveys. If you change any one of those choices, you basically get a different answer. You get the answer that world income distribution is becoming more unequal. And I will refer you to a recent study by Branko Milanovic. Milanovic has constructed the first complete data set based only on household surveys, not national income accounts, for just about all the World Bank's reporting countries. And these are his results. He's done this for 2 years, 1988 and 1993, so only 5 years separating. And basically he finds that using household surveys only, the Gini coefficient between these 5 years has gone up by 6%. And now if you take a rather more complicated measure of inequality, that is the richest, the top decile to the median, and then the poorest to the median. If you look at the richest decile to the median, what you see is that the rich are pulling away from the median by a lot, by 23% over the 5 years, and the poorest, on the other hand, are falling relative to the median. Now, there are a lot of people who say household surveys are not a good basis for doing this, but there's a tremendous amount of controversy between statisticians on this point. But it's not just this kind of data that I would point to. There is also a huge, in fact, the best data of all, in the sense of going back the furthest in time and being most systematic across countries, is to do with data on the dispersion of industrial pay in all countries in the world. And we have this data from the early 1960s right up to the present. Basically, this data shows very clearly that from the early 60s to the early 80s, the dispersion in industrial pay, that is between the pay of, workers in machine tools, in oil refining on the one hand, and workers in garments and footwear on the other, the dispersion in industrial pay was roughly constant or even declining from the early 60s to the early 80s. But since 1982, there was a turning point. And since 1982, the trend is clearly and unambiguously and strongly towards a widening in industrial pay dispersion. Now, Martin Wolf has an answer to that, but I'll take that in the questions if you will. If you could find this, all this stuff, on the University of Texas website under the name of Jamie Galbraith, he's been using this data in a very systematic way in connection with his work on trends in world income distribution. And just let me mention quickly in passing something else, which is that if you take account of environmental costs, that is, if you deflate the growth of, say, Southeast Asian, Northeast Asian countries, think of Indonesia, if you deflate their income growth by depletion of environmental resources like forests, then that does make a very big difference to their growth rates. Instead of Indonesia having growth rates of 7, 8, 9%, it has growth rates of 3 or 4% when you take account of environmental costs. And that in itself means that any sort of catch-up effect in their incomes is actually less than appears to be the case if you don't take account of environmental costs. So now I am going on to assuming that world income distribution is indeed becoming more unequal, and I want to talk about the causes. Well, very quickly. One cause is obviously that population growth is much faster here than it is up there. I won't say anything more about that. Another cause is declining terms of trade of the producers down here relative to their imports of things from up here. Declining terms of trade, dramatically declining. I want to say a bit more about the third and fourth factors. The third one is a strong tendency for high value-added activities such as research and development, such as marketing, the high value-added activities to concentrate in these countries, and for new rounds, new investment in the high value-added activities to be done in those countries rather than being dispersed out to the lower cost countries. In fact, it's quite dramatic. Even if you look at R&D labs in Singapore, which, I mean, is a pretty high income place, it turns out that R&D labs in Singapore are not doing full-blown R&D. They're doing sort of adapting products to the local market or listening to what other companies in Singapore are doing, but they're not doing full-blown R&D. The full-blown R&D is being held in Europe and North America. And it's an interesting question of why this is, why there is this strong agglomeration effect, this tendency for new rounds of high value-added added activities to concentrate in the places where previous rounds were being done rather than dispersed out. I see I don't have time to go into this except to say that LSE geographers have been doing quite a lot of work on this question, but also the economist, the professor of economics here, John Sutton, has been doing some interesting analytical work on why this tendency for agglomeration takes place. But the result of it is, the result, whatever the cause is, the result is to keep the old OECD countries, to keep them all from falling down the economic hierarchy of nations towards the middle income countries. In fact, I'm a New Zealander, and one of the things I worry about in the case of New Zealand is that its population is simply too small to sustain these sort of agglomeration economies, to keep highly specialized professionals, like me, for example, in the country. And so there's a sort of threshold effect below which more and more people just leave. Of course, if New Zealanders go to Australia, then that does raise the average IQ on both sides of the Tasman. So it's a benefit to Australia. The fourth factor in terms of what's making for this widening, if there is a widening, the fourth factor has to do with debt. Debt and the payment system. My argument here is that debt and the payment system, the combination of these two things, generates a tendency for a widening of world income distribution. In fact, I would put it this way. There is an original sin which is embedded in the world economy, and this original sin is what tends to generate this widening effect. It tends to generate a general tendency to financial fragility. It tends to slow down the development of developing countries, and at the same time accelerates the growth of the industrialized countries, especially the United States. The original sin is the requirement that economic actors of all but a few hard currency countries must acquire hard currency, and this is mainly dollars, in order to interact with the world economy and make cross-border payments. That is, they cannot make cross-border payments in their own currency. So the countries that borrow must export in order to repay their debt and export to hard currency areas. What are the effects of this? Well, one effect is that the imperative on countries, developing countries, to export in order to repay debts in hard currency means that their governments have an incentive to press down upon wages and other costs in order to gain competitiveness vis-a-vis rival producers of export products, and to shortchange efforts to strengthen the tendency for domestic demand to be a major source of growth. The economy tends to be oriented towards external markets as a source of growth, as distinct from the industrialized countries, which have domestic demand as their main source of growth. The second effect is that the economy is exposed to devaluation risk and other forms of financial fragility. For example, if companies borrow in dollars in order to finance projects that earn in national currency, then a devaluation, which increases the number of units of national currency needed to repay a given dollar debt, can tip whole swathes of the economy into insolvency. And basically, that's what happened in the East Asia crisis of 1997-98. But this same system, the same original sin in the payment system, ensures that the United States receives a large inflow of cheap capital from the rest of the world and is therefore able to keep its interest rates very low and its rate of investment relatively very high. And this is because actors in the rest of the world, especially governments that are watching their foreign exchange reserves, want to hold US assets, especially US government securities, as protection against the instabilities of foreign exchange markets. And in holding US assets, they in effect lend cheaply to US residents. And so this is the origin of the paradox that the world's richest country is also the world's richest, having biggest debtor. It's the biggest recipient of foreign capital inflows. So with this huge volume of foreign capital inflows coming into the US, amounting to about 5% of gross domestic product, the US can live beyond its means. And because it's living beyond its means, this bolsters its hegemonic status in setting the rules of the world economy by living beyond its means. And this is the system that allows it to continue to do so. But this points to a larger paradox of globalization. The paradox is this: most countries in the world experience globalization, now meaning free movement of finance and currency volatility, they experience globalization in this sense as a constraint on government policy making. Government policy is constrained by these pro-cyclical movements of capital. But there's one exception, and that is the US. The US government experiences globalization in this sense, with free movement of finance and with the dollar not anchored to gold, not tied to gold, the dollar being able to be just created. The US government experiences globalization as a freeing, as a liberation from international constraints, such as, for example, the Bretton Woods constraints. It allows the US to go on running these huge deficits, just provided that people in the rest of the world want to hold US assets. And they want to hold U.S. assets because of the instability of the foreign exchange markets, and U.S. assets are a hedge against those instabilities. So that globalization allows U.S. monetary policy to be set entirely according to U.S. domestic conditions, to be set according to fighting inflation or reducing unemployment or reducing stock market bubbles, more or less ignoring conditions in the rest of the world, whereas the European Central Bank or the Bank of Japan cannot afford to set monetary policy just according to domestic conditions. It must take account of what the US is doing. So that's the paradox of globalization. It constrains all governments but one, and on the other hand, it liberates the United States. And that may not be, that is quite possibly the reason why US government tends to be very keen on financial globalization for everybody. So let me come to the third part, what is to be done? And I'll just quickly run down about five headings here, and if you like, we can discuss some of them in the discussion. The first thing about what is to be done is that development agencies like the World Bank, like DFID, also development academics, really must give more attention than they are to the question of how to increase the internal integration of developing countries. And I say that to make the contrast between the present preoccupation with how to increase the external integration of developing countries. When I talk about increasing internal integration, I'm not arguing for a return to old-style import substitution as practiced in Latin America or in India. What I am arguing for is more emphasis on the role of the state in, for example, fostering supply linkages between domestic firms and the subsidiaries of multinational corporations. I did a study called Governing the Market, as David mentioned, which is about the East Asian development experience, especially with industrial policy. And I was very struck by the fact that the government of Taiwan and the government of Korea both did a lot of very, apparently very small scale industrial policy, which really focused upon using the authority of the state, not necessarily a lot of state money, but the authority of the state to encourage multinational corporations or their subsidiaries operating in Taiwan or in Korea to build supply links with domestic firms rather than to keep importing their raw materials and their intermediate inputs. The authority of the state was used to build these supply links. And I suggest that if you think of research subjects according to the criterion of the development importance of research on this subject over the amount of attention being given to this subject, then in terms of that ratio, one of the highest items of all is this question of how to build supply links between domestic firms and the subsidiaries of multinational corporations. It may seem like an obvious thing to say, a small and obvious thing to say, but the fact of the matter is that the World Bank, for example, is doing virtually none of this kind of thing. The World Bank is chasing this good governance agenda, this participation agenda, democratization, as well as integrating into the world economy type agenda. But the bank is hardly doing anything on things like how to build supply links between domestic firms and subsidiaries of multinational corporations. A second key item on my agenda of what is to be done is national capital controls. National capital controls, meaning controls that can be applied unilaterally by a government. And I'm a bit worried about all this current discussion about the Tobin tax, that it may divert attention from the much more feasible agenda simply of getting the IMF and therefore the American Treasury to accept the legitimacy of countries using national capital controls to influence the flows of finance across their borders, influence the entry and exit of foreign financial firms as a normal instrument of economic management. And I suggest that current developments in terms of techniques of tracking terrorist money, techniques of going after people who are money laundering, these techniques may actually be quite useful for the design of national capital controls used as a normal instrument of economic management. We can come back to that. My third item on the agenda, we have to dissuade the American government from pushing ahead with its very aggressive policy on intellectual property rights. The American government is really trying to press an agenda on through the WTO, which would give tremendous power to US firms to patent all over the world and to kind of lock in a flow of technological rents coming back to US entities for the foreseeable future. I think this would be a very polarizing, talk about a widening of that gap, this would be a very polarizing move if the WTO were to accept the American proposals on intellectual property rights. Developing countries really have to oppose that agenda. My fourth point, just one or two sentences, on the governance of the World Bank and the IMF. The current governance of these organizations is subject to a basic moral hazard problem. The moral hazard problem is that the government that is setting the policy, setting the rules of these organizations, the wealthy governments, are governments that know they will never have to apply to themselves what they require the other governments, developing country governments, to do. And that seems to me basically wrong. The way to change this is to change, at least one thing to do, is to change the voting system. Currently, the voting system is entirely according to capital contributions. What we need to move towards is a double voting criterion. One, for capital contributions, two, for population. So that anything approved by the organization would have to, for example, have a majority support from countries representing more than half of the capital contributions and countries representing more than half of the members' population. And indeed, the European Central Bank and also the Global Environmental Facility have been operating with a double voting criteria for weight to the poorer countries. So that's one way by which these organizations could be made change direction in a way that would be more beneficial to developing countries. One simple thing they might do is to do more of their lending in the national currency of the countries that they're lending to, so that the countries can repay in their own currency, not have to get US dollars in order to repay. And then my final point is that we could make a big improvement. This is really high in the sky. By abolishing foreign exchange markets, we could follow a suggestion that Keynes made at the Bretton Woods negotiations of establishing an international clearing agency, ICA. The point about this agency is that it would allow countries to engage in international trade and investment in their own currencies, rather than having to earn hard currency in order to do so. This international clearing agency would hold reserves and hold securities of all the member countries inside itself and would simply make internal adjustments, settling balances between countries internally. And there would be a formula for making exchange rate adjustments from time to time. The European Payments Union in the 1950s is an example of such a clearinghouse. And it seems to me that given the sort of fragilities, the instabilities to which the world is exposed by the huge amounts of capital sloshing around foreign exchange markets, that we might well have a more stable, more prosperous world if we were to move in this direction. Well, finally then, where would the political support come from for any of this? I have to say I'm very pessimistic, having looked closely at the insides of the World Bank. I'm very pessimistic about concerted action from developing countries. But I am slightly more optimistic about what is happening in Europe. And I think the world would be a better place if these international organizations were less dominated by the Americans, even if that was just to make them into more of a duopoly, with the Europeans having a stronger voice. If you look at what the European G4 are doing, that's Germany, Britain, France, Italy, they're beginning to concert their policies, their views, before each of them talks to the Americans. That is something new. They used to each talk to the Americans and then talk to each other. Now they're talking to each other before talking to the Americans. And so, for example, there is a European view now to oppose this crazy American idea of shifting EIDA, that is the soft loan facility of the bank, shifting EIDA entirely for 50% to grants. That would be the end of EIDA. Either it would be the end of EIDA, or it would give the US Congress even more influence over EIDA than the US Congress currently has. Europeans are opposing that idea. Europeans are pushing the idea of tighter regulation of hedge funds against American opposition. That's a good idea. And I really will finish on this point. A tiny milestone in the development of European, common European views occurred in mid-2000 when the G7 finance ministers met in Japan. And Kayo Kopfeder, who is the number one official in the German finance ministry, put a great deal of effort into persuading all four of the European G7 finance ministers to fly to Japan on a Luftwaffe aircraft. Gordon Brown's office, as you can imagine, was very nervous about Gordon Brown getting onto a Luftwaffe aircraft, but he was eventually persuaded to do so when he was assured that all the other three would also be on that same plane. So what happened in Japan was that these four finance ministers from Europe arrived at the same time. They walked into the VIP lounge, and there, standing, having just arrived, was none other than Larry Summers, the US Treasury Secretary. And he looked around and he saw this posse of four European finance ministers coming in, and he was shocked. And they were delighted by the fact that he was shocked. That was the whole point. They were symbolizing that they had come together. They were a group, and they weren't simply four separate countries talking each individually to the Americans. So that's a small little milestone in the development of a concerted European voice. So just let me summarize. I'm saying that, first of all, we really don't know what is happening to the number of absolute poor in the world. It's such a wide margin of error, we don't know. Number two, world income inequality is clearly and unambiguously widening if we use market exchange rates. Number three, the balance of evidence is that if we use purchasing power parity and most of the other combinations, if we use purchasing power parity, the balance of evidence is that world income inequality is also widening. It's certainly not getting better. And then I've talked about the causes, the character of modern technological change contributing to the widening, and then finally this point about the payment system and debt, this combination of payment system and debt, which is a powerful centrifugal force operating in the world economy. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for a talk of exemplary analytical precision, clarity, and keeping the talk down to a wonderful time. We have quite a lot of time for questions, at least half an hour. In order to encourage wide participation, I'd like, if it's okay with you, Robert, to take clusters of questions, maybe 3 to 5, so you might need a piece of paper. We've got roaming mics, I hope. Yes, we do. So let's take 3 to 5 questions to begin with, and then after we have some sense of the range of issues on the table, perhaps you'd like to take your first response. So, lots of questions here. I'm going to start with 2 or 3 down here and then come to 2 or 3 up there. Okay, question number one over here. No, it's a mic's coming. Question number two. Anyone more down here? Question number three.
Yeah, over there. Sir, my question was, you sort of go on about how globalization... I'm here. Yeah? Well, sort of how globalization is not as good as it looks, and how it's actually increasing inequality. But a lot of the sort of Taiwan, Korea, Singapore, who did open up their economy, did have a tremendous growth rate and increasing GDP per capita, compared to countries like India and Pakistan, which were sort of partially closed. And even when the Asian crisis hit these countries, say, they came down from the scale of 10 to 5, whereas places like India and Pakistan just remained at 4 and 5. So obviously, globalization has improved their situation.
Thank you. Second question over here, please. And then the question at the back. The back one is the next one. Yeah. It's number 2 here. Oh, it doesn't matter. You can go to the gentleman at the back, and then we'll go to the person here. And then we'll take some from the top.
So Jane Jacobs in...
You might want to use the mic.
Jane Jacobs describes Korea, how land reform, is it working? I don't know. Is it?
Yeah.
Jane Jacobs, I think it was Systems of Survival. It's like a dialogue book. She describes Korea and the state forcing through land reform the landowners, having been compensated for compulsory purchase, to invest within the country. So if you're talking about increasing the power of states in this situation, how realistic is it to think about doing that, for example, in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland?
Okay, a question over here. And then if you're thinking of asking questions at the top, perhaps you could just indicate it to me whilst he's talking. Okay, lots of questions.
If I could just ask about your attitude towards economic growth, because I think it is intimately related to the question of inequality. I mean, for example, if you could have a situation where the world economy could generate very dynamic growth, which the rich benefited from more than the poor, but the poor still benefited and got relatively richer as a result, what would be your attitude towards that?
Okay, thank you. Fourth question at the top, lady at the top. Thank you.
Your suggestions about building supply links between local suppliers and multinational subsidiaries sounds good, but surely everything in the WTO regulations, for instance, market access, national treatment, etc., work directly against that sort of preference for local companies like that.
And question number five. And then we'll give Robert a chance to come back. But there's plenty of time for several more clusters of questions.
Do you regard the World Bank and the IMF as instruments of United States foreign policy? And what can the world do about this?
Okay, Robert, that's five questions already. Let me cheat and toss one more in. If you list four factors that might explain these income trends that you've been describing, four factors. How do you weight them? What are we to make of this? Are they all equally significant, or have some been really? Are some really the key variables you'd want to stress? Okay, over to you.
Well, the good thing about taking a big cluster of questions is that I can duck some of them. Let me though begin with the first question about Taiwan and Korea. You said that Taiwan and Korea opened their economies and had subsequently faster growth, and you made the comparison with India, for example, which had a relatively closed economy, and you presumably would then go on to say that India would have had faster growth if it had a more open economy. You're touching on a very difficult issue of causation. And in fact, the World Bank has made a great deal of play with a study that shows that countries which are called globalizers have had faster growth and faster poverty reduction than countries that are non-globalizers. And it defines globalizers as countries that have had a relatively fast rate of increase of trade to GDP, and non-globalizers of countries that have not had a fast rate of growth, have had a slow rate of growth of trade to GDP. And then it finds that the globalizers have had a faster rate of growth and faster poverty reduction. It wishes you to conclude that therefore countries should, that therefore, that the globalizers were globalizers because they had liberal trade regimes. That is, that the causation was, first they reduced tariffs and non-tariff barriers, and then they had higher growth. Well, you have to look at which countries are the globalizers. The globalizers are countries like China, like India, countries that whose causal sequence was roughly the opposite. That is, they began to grow fast before they did very much by way of liberalization, and as they continued to grow fast, then they liberalized in line with the developing capacities of their firms. It was not that first they liberalized and then they had faster growth. Vietnam is another country which would be called a globalizer country. But the point is that these countries have still highly protective trade regimes, even though they have large or rising volumes of trade GDP, just as before them, Korea and Taiwan had highly protected trade regime, and yet, because protection was part of a wider industrial policy involving very high levels of investment and reinvestment and reinvestment within the national territory, this fast growth gave rise to a great deal of trade. But the trade was through a sort of strategically designed trade regime, which was designed at the margin to encourage the development of technological capacities in domestic firms. So the question behind your question and behind the World Bank studies is, okay, so you agree that Bihar, let us say, sub-Saharan African countries, would be better off if they were more integrated into the world economy, if they had higher levels of trade. Suppose you agree that. The question is how you get to how a country becomes more highly integrated. Does it become more highly integrated simply by reducing or eliminating tariff barriers and non-tariff barriers? Well, a very good example of a country that has practically no tariff barriers and practically zero tariffs is Haiti. Haiti also has practically no trade because Haiti is not growing. So it is an extreme case, but it does make the point that trade liberalization itself is not a strong propulsive force for growth. It cannot be counted upon to give subsequently faster rates of growth. To get to the point of having higher levels, rising levels of integration, it seems to me that at least the East Asian experience suggests that there has to be some degree of state steerage of markets, such as, for example, what I was talking about before, that is the state using its authority to accelerate the growth of supply linkages between domestic firms and subsidiaries of multinational corporations. That is a form of industrial policy which will help countries climb the technological ladder, and as they climb the technological ladder, they can liberalize their trade. But the propulsive force doesn't come from trade liberalization itself. That seems to me to be the lesson of the East Asian experience, the Chinese experience, the Vietnamese experience, and indeed the Indian experience. So that's
question number one. Can't take so much time with each answer because they're itching up there to come back at you.
On the point about supply links and the WTO, I agree emphatically. I think that what is happening in the WTO now, in terms of the insistence on things like national treatment, that is that each developing country must treat foreign firms exactly the same as domestic firms, I think that that is disastrous. It is certainly completely contrary to the way that just about all the successful cases of development have done. That is, in all these cases, governments have acted strategically in terms of how they gave incentives to foreign firms, to domestic firms, acted strategically always with a view of transferring capabilities from foreign firms to domestic firms. And for that purpose, it may be necessary to have non-national treatment to allow a government to give some kind of preference to domestic firms. So that's another point of the WTO agenda, where I wish there was more concerted action by developing countries to change these rules. If they concerted their actions, they could change the rules, but they don't concert their actions. That's the problem. In terms of the World Bank and the IMF being instruments of the US government, to a very considerable extent that is true. The US government benefits from the legitimacy of multilateralism. It is able to exercise great influence over these organizations on matters, not on all matters, but on matters that it signals are very important to it. There are many matters which are not so important to the U.S. Treasury. Much of the social agenda, the U.S. Treasury is perfectly happy to let the Scandinavians run with the social agenda because nothing much is at stake. But in terms of things that really do matter to the US Treasury, the US Treasury is pretty well able to get most of what it wants from these organizations, to get them to do what it wants in their dealings with their client countries. And I do think, as I've said, this is a very serious problem for the world, and that it would be a good idea to try and reduce the weight that the US can exercise within these organizations. The US is the only country that is able to wield a veto, that doesn't have to get any other country to agree with it in wielding a veto on certain kinds of decisions within these organizations. And I think that in the year 2002, that is just unacceptable. There should be a way of diffusing power, giving more power to developing countries. And this double voting criterion that I mentioned is one step that might be made, but the Europeans and the developing countries would have to concert their actions in order to get that through. I think I'm just going to duck the really difficult question, which is what to make of the case of where the rich countries have very fast growth, and so that the absolute gaps are wide between them and the poor countries are widening rapidly, but somehow or other one can make a plausible argument that the rapid growth of the rich countries is necessary for the poor countries to be better off than they otherwise would have been. I mean, that's the argument. I just find it implausible, but I'm not going to say in 1 minute why I think it's implausible. And similarly, I would respond in a rather similar spirit to David's question, which is, what is the relative causal weighting of these four factors? I can respond by saying that what astonishes me about this field of world income distribution and the associated subjects, what astonishes me about it as an outsider is how little research there has been on all these questions. If you look at IR, international relations, if you look at international political economy journals, if you look at political science journals, you will find almost nothing, no articles being written about these kind of issues. And it's only really in the last few years that within economics, in international economics, a debate has started about these kind of issues. So that, for example, in terms of this missing middle observation that I made at the beginning, where are the explanations? Actually, Danny Quark here in the economics department has been doing a bit of work on this and has come up with an explanation of sorts about the missing middle. But my general point is that there is very little research on the things that I have been talking about. And that's why, at this preliminary stage, I'm happy to just leave these things as a list.
All right, we'll let you get away with that for the time being. Opening bids for 5 more questions. Lady over here, number 1. Number 2. Then we'll come upstairs again. Go for it.
This is more from an IP perspective, really. To me, it seems that you are critical of the US hegemony on the one hand, and you've got a Eurocentric project on the other, which you've outlined at the last minute. And do you not think by shifting the balance of power from the US to G4 or EU, will you not still have a system of rich versus the poor? What difference will it make?
Thank you. Question over here, number 2. Then we'll take 3 from upstairs. Go.
Yeah. In Paul Hurst's book, Globalization in Question, over here, down on the floor, bottom right. Hi. he posits the idea of dual economies, which seem to be replicated in your original OHP, the economies that have small outward prosperous sectors plugged into the world economy and declining agriculture in the interior. And he pointed out that economically speaking, that caused all sorts of problems, primarily in terms of politics, the inequality within countries and the political consequences that might flow from that. and that could be then a drag on political growth. And I would be interested in any comment you might have about that.
Thank you. Number three, the three of you, your hands up there, all simultaneously, so it'll be arbitrary.
You mentioned the US proposal to shift 50% of the International Development Agency's or IDA's resources into grants. This proposal has been strengthened in the post-September 11th period. But the idea behind this, apart from stopping debt build-up, is that poverty can be a breeding ground for terrorism, and therefore the US wants to reduce poverty as soon as possible. But poverty is not necessarily the main reason for terrorism. Disempowerment, disrespect, and marginalization are. What are your views on this issue?
A couple more up here. Thanks. And then we'll come out.
Sorry, can I ask the next question?
Yeah.
Can you clarify whether or not you oppose the idea of free movement of capital, free movement of goods, or not? And also, at least within the context of the European Union, the free movement of goods and capital, this idea is linked with the idea of free movement of people and services. Do you oppose that as well, especially after abolishing the free exchange, currency exchange system?
Thank you very much. And the question up there, be waiting patiently.
Yes, while we all discuss what globalization is, could you actually make the case to say that globalization is really a more complex form of international political economy with occasionally quite calculated economic warfare?
And the lady over here, the final question in this cluster.
Can I just clarify that, that last point was, is globalization a form of economic warfare, or occasional economic warfare?
Complex international political economy, kind of almost traditional style, with occasionally quite calculated economic warfare. Think of, say, Southeast Asia.
And the lady over here, just, thank you.
How useful do you think the less than a dollar tool is, and are there alternatives to it you might suggest?
Did you catch that?
No, I didn't.
Sorry, could you repeat it a bit closer to the mic?
It's about the less than a dollar tool in order to measure poverty. I'm wondering whether you think it is useful, because there is much controversy about it, and whether there are any other alternatives you have thought of.
Okay, that was five questions. So let me just abuse the chair again and just go back to my sixth question. If we don't weight these causal factors, how can we be sure? How can we be sure your set of five prescriptions are correctly formulated in terms of emphasis? For example, then, number of notable absences, let's say issues around fertility control, reproductive freedom, population issues. I mean, it seems to me your five factors that you end with do weight actually a view about causal origins. So we'll come on to another five questions.
Okay. Well, the first question was about whether my duopoly, that is a greater European voice, would not simply perpetuate the existing division between rich and poor. Yes, of course it would, but I have studied in great detail the inner workings of the World Bank, and I have come away from that quite pessimistic about the chances that developing countries, China, Brazil, India, sub-Saharan African countries, can concert their actions around a common agenda such that they could wield the influence that they would be able to influence, would be able to wield if they could concert their actions. I'm very pessimistic about that actually happening. The conflicts of interest between them, which prevent them coming together, are very great. And so I think my bottom line is that duopoly is better than monopoly. It as simple as that. There's a bit more scope for progressive development ideas to be injected into these organizations through the Europeans than there would be otherwise. On the point about dual economies, just let me say that that is very much what I had in mind when I said that development studies generally and the development agencies also have to give more attention to the question of strengthening the internal articulation, the internal integration of developing countries than they are currently doing. For those of you who are outside development studies, that may seem just a banal thing to say, but it is truly extraordinary that once you see that point, you see that, for example, the World Bank is doing very little by way of measures that would specifically strengthen internal articulation of these economies. One of the results is that the emphasis upon the external integration of these economies means that wages tend to be seen only as a cost. You try and keep down wages to make your exports more competitive. You don't see wages also as a source of demand because most of your production is not going into the domestic market. And therefore, sort of social democratic or other forms of political arrangements which involve class alliances between capital and labor are much more difficult in an economy that is highly integrated into the external world market, but not integrated internally, precisely for this reason that wages are only seen as a cost, they're not also seen as a source of demand. So I very much agree with the implication of your question. On terrorism, I think certainly, yes, disempowerment is and sense of alienation, relative deprivation, is very important. But in some rather broad and unspecific kind of way, I also think that poverty, this sort of degree of income inequality, especially between the middle income, the so-called middle income countries and the rich countries, that is a sort of background factor that is surely making for more dissatisfaction amongst the young people being brought up in these middle income countries, and so is likely to kind of predispose both to migration and to various kinds of actions, one small part of which is terrorism. On the question of my view about free trade and free goods, let me just say that I think that the sort of neoliberal paradigm, which very much privileges free trade, free movement of capital, I think that broadly speaking, this is a gross overstatement, but broadly speaking, the set of policies that come from that neoliberal paradigm are appropriate for rich country conditions. My disagreement is with the proposition that is generally held that the same kind of economic framework is also appropriate for countries down at the bottom end of the income distribution. I think that to require countries down here to integrate into a world framework that is essentially neoliberal is a prescription for not catching up. Developing countries need to follow, according to my argument, a different set of policies according to the principles that I call governing the market, as distinct from a neoliberal agenda. But I do recognize that neoliberal principles are broadly speaking appropriate in rich country conditions. The question of whether they're appropriate for developing countries that is at issue. On the point about globalization as economic warfare, the one point I make is this, that I have always been struck by the fact that in the negotiations for a, what was it called, a financial services agreement being carried out, I think, in the WTO, in about 1996, a number of developing countries, especially in Southeast Asia, were holding out. They were not wanting to grant the concessions that the US and other wealthy country governments wanted them to grant. They were holding out. And then came the Asian crisis. And these countries suddenly lost all their bargaining power. And by December 1997, they signed on. They basically had no choice because the IMF put to them the proposition that either you sign on this and get our help, or we don't give you the help that you need. So that is the use of hard economic power, certainly. Whether you want to call it economic warfare is another question. But it is an example of hard economic power in the interests of opening up world capital markets, including in developing countries. I think I will skip the question about the poverty line. There are certainly difficult conceptual issues about what would be an appropriate world poverty line. How would you define it in terms of calorific requirements? How would you operationalize it if it were in terms of calorific requirements? But I put all that aside. Finally, on David's question, if I don't rank the causal factors, how can I know which prescriptions are most important? Well, the short answer is I don't know which prescriptions are most important. I'm only talking about the things that interest me. So that's the that's the criterion of selection, the criterion of relevance that I use. Things that interest me as distinct from things which in some objective sense are more important.
All right, well, we're almost running out of time. Some of you are beginning to slip away. Maybe we'll have a couple of questions, but before more people go, I would just like to say that this is, as I said before, this is the second of a series of lectures on globalization and economic governance. The third is by, he's a legitimate Bob, by Bob Goodin, on the 20th of March at 6:30 here, who will be pursuing these issues, but rather more speaking from a normative point of view and the point of view of a political philosopher, and the title of his talk is Globalizing Justice. So it's a nice development of a set of arguments and considerations that we started some weeks ago and will continue to develop. So that's the 20th of March, 6:30 here. People are leaving, which I think suggests that actually 8 o'clock is time to wrap up. So in light of the voting by your feet, I want to just thank you very much again for an excellent talk.